Hello, 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 and welcome to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's queer media. And we are coming from the capital to all over the place in a conversation today that is very, very Canadian, of course. We should first, of course, introduce everybody in the room. Why didn't you all introduce yourself, starting with Sebastian?
Well, you already introduced me, so well. I'm Sebastian. Well done. Thank you. Please.
Gary Lacasse. I'm the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society.
Cool. And I'm Jeremy Dias. I'm the executive director of the Canadian Center for Gender and Sexual Diversity.
Excellent. And today's topic, we're really looking at the changes, or the proposed changes, although I think they might actually be the changes, to what was a little while ago a 5-year ban on men that have sex with men donating blood. It is now a 1-year deferral period, I think is the terminology they're using, on men that have sex with men donating blood. So we're really having a conversation about this. We have reached out to Canadian Blood Services, and we may be adding an interview about that conversation to this episode a little later on. Because, of course, we're sure that CBS is amongst the best place to be able to provide us some of the answers. But in the meantime, let's kind of get a bit of context. Why was there a ban to even begin with? Like, why was there a ban on gay men donating blood?
Well, in the 80s, it made a lot of sense because they were still trying to figure out... at the time, they actually, in the early 80s, they were still unsure as to what was causing AIDS. So to call it HIV/AIDS in the context of the early 80s is not completely accurate. It's kind of revisionism. But they knew that it had something to do, probably, with the blood. And so they put a full ban on men who have sex with men donating blood. Until they figured out what it was, what was the vector, how was it working. And then by the, I think it was mid-90s when they had actually isolated the HIV virus. Actually, I think it was 95 when they did that, wasn't it?
Antiretrovirals came in 96, so I believe that the, it was about 95, 96.
Yeah. So around then when they actually figured out the mechanism and they started getting detection out by, I think it was 98, 99, they started getting moderately good detection. By the early 2000s, it didn't necessarily make as much sense anymore, but in the first place, putting an altogether ban until they figured out what was going on, you know, it was restrictive, but in the, at least in the context of the 80s, it was sensible.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what it's important to know that. And I know, I mean, I was not here at the time. But I believe that there was an infected blood scandal in Canada that kind of shocked a lot of folks.
Yeah, there was
The Crever report. Yeah, the blood tainted supply that was there, in the and the Crever Commission came out with the recommendations that clearly stated that the Red Cross and the Minister of Health, the Health Canada, were to blame for the tainted blood scandal. And there were charges brought up against the people involved and the private companies, doctors, and so on, because the tests that were being done on our blood supply were not effective and weren't done properly. So that's what brought the deferral in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that we take
the historical context.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Very important.
I mean, a lot of this, I mean, you really have to sort of preface or afterword everything with at the time, you know, it made sense at the time, or it made sense given what we knew, or we did what we did given the context. But a lot of things have changed, and we're sort of currently, a lot of the rules and systems in place are based on old data or based on old prejudices of good data or various.
Because I think it's important. One of the things that people have really critiqued the ban on is that it's a blanket ban on an entire group of people, regardless of what the individuals do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, myself or my partner could have monogamous sex and be HIV negative for 20 years, and still there is a ban unless we go celibate for 1 year, because we're treated as a grouping, which I think is where a lot of the derision is coming from. I think it's important that we also recognize that Canada is one of the few that have done some progress on this. I just did a quick search now, and Germany and Denmark and Belgium still have an indefinite ban, which is concerning. Although a couple of years ago, the EU's top court, when they were challenged by a French individual, did say that any ban needs to be justified. So I don't know what their justification is, but apparently they must still have one in order to have that ban in place.
Well, that may not be true for Belgium, because every so often they just don't have a government for a while.
Okay, that happened like once, okay? It's like that one time for like 5 years, you know, and you keep bringing it up. There's poor Belgians. You know, if we've got the people at the embassy listening and they're like, oh, well, just can't get away with it.
But they still function better as a country than most others. That's the irony.
Bureaucrats save the day. So, Jay, I mean, are you familiar with the history of the blood ban?
Yeah, so we actually are one of the founding members of the working group on the MSM file at Canadian Blood Services. And the working group is open to any LGBTQ or interested organization. And there's a number of agencies that have been working on the file. And you know, just to dovetail on what's been said already, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, when Canadian Blood Services, at the time the Red Cross, infected people with, you know, HIV, it was devastating. I mean, we didn't have medication, we didn't have means to treat these people. Many of them died, and many people rely on the blood service. You know, I have family members who rely on, you know, weekly or monthly transfusions. And I think, you know, after the crisis, when, you know, the Red Cross was, you know, absolved, and then we built up Canadian Blood Services and HEMA Quebec, you know, from a historical perspective, I mean, the biggest change was, you know, other than these policies, of course, was that they decided that they're not making any policies or rules without any research. And that's been something that they've stuck to for a really long time. And I think one of the things that we've learned on this working group since 2012 with all of these LGBTQ or agencies from across the country is that we don't take research. We don't, when someone dies, we don't say, what was, you know, your sexual activity, you know? It's, it's, are you gay? Are you straight? You know, are you bi? Are you trans? Are you queer? And then what's your HIV status? And I think, you know, the research that we're collecting is flawed. So, I mean, you know, while the one-year deferral change is not that exciting, I mean, the biggest exciting thing for us is $3 million to do research. Like, that's fantastic. That's exactly what the working group and what other bodies need to prove so that we can, you know, eliminate this ban entirely. And so, I mean, I guess as a member of the working group, you know, it's very exciting that we're finally getting this research. And the data from this research is not just going to be helpful to address the ban, but I think it's also going to be helpful to measure the behaviors of Canadians when it comes to, you know, what increases one's risk. Because it's not, you know, sexual orientation, it's behavior. So let's find out what behaviors increase our risk and what behaviors don't.
I think it's important that you mention that because in France, they're shifting to a risk-based model. In South Africa, they also have that same model, as well as Spain. I'm not sure what the model is in Italy or Mexico or Argentina. And these are all countries that currently do not have a ban on men having sex with men donating blood.
Well, and you have to look at the reasons why. I mean, if you look at the UK, for example, there was a break in the ban for a really long time. And why? Because gay men weren't testing, right? So if we said, all right, well, you know what? Let's get all these gay men to start donating blood. It was a great way of testing mass populations for HIV and other sexually transmitted and bloodborne infections. And then, of course, getting people treatment. So, I mean, the means by which we can address the ban and the mechanisms can be different. I mean, we don't have to just look at eliminating the ban because it's wrong. We could also look at, you know, using research as a tool to eliminate the ban. And to be frank, you know, if we as a community, right, whether we talk about LGBTQ people, whether we talk about people who, you know, are allies to the LGBTQ community, but if we as a community remove this ban just because it's morally wrong, right, not based on research, what's to say that another group's going to come in and start changing Health Canada policy because it's wrong? And while today it might benefit us, what about tomorrow? And I think, you know, if we look at that historically, I mean, it's that morality argument that was used to put this ban in the first place, right? So I think, you know, if we stick to our guns and say, you know what, this should all be research-led, then let's make it research-led. Then let's work together to get the research that we need to make that happen. And if you look at Vancouver, for example, has been running blood donation clinics for gay men in Vancouver to start collecting that data. You know, mm-hmm. the $3 million is going to help collect that data. Blood Services has, and HEMA Quebec have a $1.5 million grant for researchers to do that. One of the reasons why it hasn't been taken up is because universities and professors don't have the infrastructure to do it. So it's about also reconstructing and rebuilding a system.
I want to touch on some of the points you made there. You referenced the Rainbow Clinic in BC, and they actually take donations of blood for research purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And strictly being that, you know, if there is a chance it has HIV, then perhaps it's not that important if you're studying something to do with cancer or something. You can screen that out in the process, but you're not putting it back into another human, which is why they can get away with it. But it's really important to differentiate the fact that this Rainbow Clinic is taking blood donations for scientific research only.
Yep.
It's not an exception to the blood ban rule. Now, Gary, you mentioned when we were in the other room a little earlier that there is an organization that works with folks who went through the infected blood scandal.
Yeah, it's called bloodwatch.org, and their position is that they want the deferral period brought down to zero. And that's what the Canadian AIDS Society's position is also. Because we have the technology to test our blood supply correctly now. So we see that we can have periods of exclusion, like with any other populations. But the Blood Watch, what they're saying is that they're really looking at making sure that our blood supply is safe and we don't pay for the blood that we're receiving. So that's their stance, and that's our stance also.
Mm-hmm. Can you expand on what you mean by paying for the blood we're receiving?
Well, there's some places in Saskatchewan that are collecting blood and giving money to the person donating their blood.
So like in America?
Yeah, like in America, yeah. which is the demographics giving the blood is not the best either. So that's mm-hmm. where we have to look at the how we're moving forward. And we have to make sure and ensure that the blood system and the collection of blood is made by professionals and is following data that shows how to do it correctly and safely. Like if we look at what I find funny is that when we're looking at with the $3 million, why don't we use that money to look at what's been done in the countries that have brought the deferral down to zero, look at mm-hmm. that documentation and that mm-hmm. research, and then build upon it, not start the whole wheel at zero.
Yeah,
I think you've got a great point there. In 2013, Britain dropped down to 1 year, 2 or 3 years ahead of Canada. And then 1 year later, Northern Ireland also dropped down to 1 year. But at that time, they announced that they were doing major research into what the risks are and so on and so forth. So these countries are of, you know, and it's Britain, you know, the National Health Service. I think Canada in some ways often looks in that direction to see what's being done. So you're right, there is a lot of work here that is already being done. And, you know, I'm sure South Africa and Italy and France would not have began this process willy-nilly. You know, it's like I'm sure they have some studies there.
I think it's worth clarifying what kind of research is being done, though. So, like, I know one of the things they're very interested in North America in general, is looking at demographics. Who are the high-risk groups? Who can we... who's it reasonable to do extra testing for? But really, that comes down to, like, the racialization of HIV. And also, mm-hmm. you know, if you are a young woman from India, you actually are, statistically speaking, at a higher risk than a lot of other groups. But I think this blood watch approach of just, what's up with that? I mean, there are plenty of heterosexual white middle class men in Canada who also have been infected by HIV. Why don't we just figure out how to test thoroughly and across the board and ignore demographic information? and for that, we don't need to do our own research. If you are looking at demographic research in high risk groups in Canada, then absolutely. But I mean, that would be more about targeting harm reduction practices, safer mm-hmm. sex practices, education practices, you know, who do you target in terms of helping them, but it doesn't necessarily help with the quality of the blood. If you're looking at the quality of the blood, we can just, you know, just take that research straight from Northern Ireland or Germany or wherever, France, and just say, you know, this is good research. Okay, let's run with this.
That I'm in agreement with what you said, but if we had been on the cusp of research and looking at harm reduction in the behavioral status instead of looking at it by sheer numbers of how many infected, where mm-hmm. the demographics are, I think we'd be further ahead in our research process at the moment. We're just starting to do behavioral research, mm-hmm. which is, to me, 30 years into the epidemic, ridiculous. There has been some behavioral by Joannetsis at LUCAM and some others across Canada. Vancouver's a leading, Toronto also, and a group that our co-host, our co-speaker just talked about are doing amazing behavioral research, and we have to continue that. But the basis is that our rates are increasing of HIV transmissions at the moment. So we have to get to a safe place.
I think it's important we don't paint with one broad brush. Now, in Ontario, the rate of infection is just over half is men that have sex with men. And I want to delve into that in just a second. But in one or two provinces in Canada, the highest infection rate is within heterosexual couples. So in those provinces, are they blanketed banned from having sex for a year? In Saskatchewan, it's intravenous drug use that is the highest infection rate. And I think they're banned anyway, just because, you know, there's a risk. But the idea that it just doesn't make much sense. And I was looking at Ottawa. I was like, okay, what's the picture like in Ottawa? And these numbers are from 2011. They had 2,300 cases of chlamydia compared to 70 cases of HIV. Syphilis came in at 81 cases. But syphilis isn't, you know, it's or gonorrhea's three times that number. Mm-hmm. But are we screening out everyone with gonorrhea? It's just
gonorrhea. But
B might be a better example.
Are they bloodborne though?
Yeah, I think hepatitis.
Because the blood scandal in the late 90s also included hepatitis.
Yeah. Yeah.
as a contaminant.
Well, they were double the amount of Hep cases than HIV cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly it. And with the Trevor Commission, that's exactly what they pointed out. Yeah, and we used to call Hep C in those days non-Hep A or B.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the things are changing and we are where we are discussing today. But we look at the rates of transmission, and that's what's bothering our local health authorities, is that HIV is maintaining or rising mm-hmm. in the gay population I'm talking about specifically. And the STBBIs like gonorrhea, and the non-responsive gonorrheas that are happening only in the gay population.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an indicator. You know, when we talk about numbers, that's an indicator that something's happening. Mm-hmm. And the chlamydia cases and the syphilis cases are rising also, and we're treating syphilis with intravenous treatment, like, because it's become so resistant. So we mm-hmm. have to, as a community, I think, take responsibility for it and start talking about our behavior, as we said before, and coming out with more elaborate toolkit for prevention. But a global prevention that's not only HIV, but all the other STBBIs too have to be taken into account.
A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Dr. Paul McPherson out of the Ottawa Hospital, and we were talking about HIV infection rates. And he was really speaking to the issue that gay men really do not seek healthcare attention. They get screened for diabetes and heart and stroke, and he said that gay men are quite good at not getting diabetes, but when it comes to anything gay related, it's a non-starter.
It's not that. I'm sorry, because from my own personal experience, when you go see a doctor, like I have diabetes I've been diagnosed for the last 3 months. Never has. We'll do a blood test. Well, can you do my HIV screening at the same time? I'm a gay man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you do my chlamydia and all the other swipes that you have to do? Oh, why would I do that?
Yeah.
So our professionals in the healthcare system are not all up to date on what to do. And that's one of the issues.
I think they're mostly just convinced that we all have boogie fever.
From Boogie Wonderland. Did you catch it there?
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to cut to an interview from Daily Extra. They interviewed the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, on this topic. And after that, we'll be jumping to a song. And I'll explain why I chose that one just after this.
Carney's platform saying the policy is discriminatory, stigmatizing, and ignores science. But this week, it was announced that the deferral period will stay, but go down a year. There's no scientific evidence to say that 1 year is better than 5 years. So why keep the ban at all?
Yeah, I have to say, quite frankly, I was a little disappointed when that came out. I understand that going from 5 years to 1 year is a small step in the right direction, but it doesn't make one whit of difference in the vast majority of people who would want to donate but who are being prohibited from it, which is why we've made sure that we're putting $3 million towards further research to make sure that we can make a real change in the coming years towards keeping the promise we made. It's frustrating to me, but sometimes the system moves slower than even a prime minister is able to make a difference.
So why can't you implement that change?
Was another senseless shooting, this time at a dance club in Orlando, Florida. A dance club. It left 49 people dead.
The most deadly shooting in American history.
There are a lot of Americans watching right now who want to know what they can do to help.
I know everyone is angry right now and not really knowing how to react, but this is a time where people are looking to us as a country and how we will react.
This was an attack on the LGBT community. And hatred towards people because of sexual orientation, regardless of where it comes from, it's a betrayal of what's best in us. We cannot be afraid. We are not going to be afraid.
Nor the time you show your love. Nor the time you show your love. Sweet love.
Sweet love. you know, love is the first step.
Keep loving each other, keep respecting each other, and keep on dancing.
Hello and welcome back to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's Queer Media. That was This Sweet Love, which is actually a song by James Newell from the album Turning Down Water for Air. But this song was used actually on a dance video, which I realized before Sebastian points it out to me that you cannot see on radio.
You can't see video on radio, yeah.
Video is a visual format and radio is an audio format. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe all of their dance moves. I'm not going to do that. But it was a dance video really as a tribute to the Orlando shootings. And the other song that we have lined up for today is also another tribute that was put together by 49 artists who all came together to do this. And I think if you recall, last week we played Melissa Etheridge's tribute to Orlando as well.
Is it like a We Are the World kind of a situation?
It's called Hands. So, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was written by a gay composer, okay, which is pretty cool. Anyways, I wanted to bring up just as something that jumped out to me from the interview with Justin Trudeau, I forgot his name there for a second, was that the Daily Extra interview was said that there was no scientific evidence to prove that 1 year is any better than five. Which for me, I'm like, is that accurate? Is there actually no difference?
Anything after 6 months, you don't win anything new. Because so it just has to do with the way the antibodies show up in your bloodstream, that once you have the initial infection and you start developing antibodies against them, which incidentally don't work. That's the glory of HIV, why it's so horrible. You develop antibodies, but they can't do anything. But you still get the antibodies. After 6 months, you're not going to develop new, different ones. So if you've been infected, after 6 months, it's all the same. It's either they detect it or they don't. Your body has reacted to it in the predicted manner by then, surely. And it's actually, I mean, it's not exactly 6 months. It's not like, you know, they have tiny watches and go, well, it's, you know, it's been 184 days, I guess. Whoa. No, it's like 6 months on the outside. It's probably something more like 4 to 6 months or something. But by 6 months, that's it. You don't win anything new by waiting any longer. And that's for, like, they have, because we were mentioning this earlier, there's different kinds, different qualities of tests, different levels of false positive, false negative, how much blood do you even need to run the test? Because it used to be that you almost needed like half a unit for the original tests in the late 90s, and now it's a drop usually.
You have to wait 6 months for the results.
Yeah, and it was ridiculous. Jeez. So after 6 months, there's no difference. In terms of testing, anyway, after you've been infected. So, but the difference between 1 year and 5 years, I mean, the way I see it, everything beyond 6 months, it's all the same. It's too long.
Well, I can see how 1 year to 6 months probably accounts for human error. When's the last time you had sex with a man? I'm like, I can't remember what I did on Tuesday. So it's, for me, I would be fuzzy that far back. So I can see how accounting perhaps a human error, you know, maybe on the safe side, let's round up by like another six. But yeah, no, that really confuses me. It's like, why, what biologically would be different between five and one?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at like the work that the working group did, and then of course what Health Canada released, was the reason why we went from 5 years to 1 year was to demonstrate some, I think, both symbolic progress, right? I mean, this was kind of like raising a rainbow flag on Parliament Hill. It didn't do anything. It was more symbolic. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the $3 million is really the biggest win on all of this, right? I mean, we're hosting an international conference in less than 6 months. I mean, this is huge.
And you're spot on there. I think that's exactly an important point. And the Minister of Health said that it'll be at some point. It's not a matter of question of. She said it's not a question of if. It's a question of when. And I think now that's the big thing that's really on everyone's brains is, you know, now that we were down to 1 year and they've promised all this money, what is the end point? Are we going to have to wait 3, 4, 5 years before they come up with a new idea? Are the Liberals going to be kicked out in the next election with Conservatives coming in, and then we'll have to wait another 4 years? Or, you know, like, how do we... But now that we have this research, how long is the wait at this point before we can see any more improvements?
I think when you're... I mean, I think it's like how long it takes to accumulate the research and create like a research agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the problem is that we're not doing the research in Canada. We want to, and it takes time. I mean, the working group's been around since 2012. You know, people have been doing advocacy around this issue since it started. You know, is it bullshit? Absolutely. You know, does it make you angry on the inside? Absolutely. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the things the working group did was we sat in a room with people who get, you know, daily or weekly transfusions. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you meet people who are intersectional, people who are both, you know, queer and receiving transfusions on a daily basis, you know, they don't, like, someone who receives a transfusion on a daily basis already has a disagreeable quality of life, already is struggling. And, you know, they want to be certain that they're not going to get any sicker from the things that are meant to help them. And, you know, in the same way that I think all of us in this room have a gut reaction to the ban, I think they also have a gut reaction to change. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been fortunate in Canada to not see any infections in those who are receiving blood in Canada over the last, you know, couple decades. And we're very grateful for that, right? But at the same time, you know, when you're talking about people's health, you know, they also have an emotional and visceral reaction to change. And I think that, you know, taking into account their position as well is also really critical as part of this dialogue.
In Britain, they noticed, they released, they dropped the thing down to 1 year, much like Canada has. And then about 6 months later, they said that the blood supply now is the best that it's ever been. It's for lack of a better word, clean of any kind of infections. But what they also are struggling with is that blood donorship has gone down by 40%. Only 4% of the population in the UK donates blood, and they actually have to ship it in from Poland to have enough blood available. So they could have the cleanest blood supply that there ever was, but if you don't have enough of it, that presents its own set of issues. I know that, Gary, you mentioned this as a topic of concern in an earlier conversation as well.
Yes, because if we're shipping in, like, even plasma, we're shipping in from other countries, even in Canada, like treatments, if IVIG treatments are shipped in from pharmaceuticals. Where does the blood come from? Questionable. So when you look at the supply of the blood system, they're saying that we don't have enough blood in our own systems to supply demand. Supply and demand is off kilter a bit. So you have to make sure that where the private companies who are selling these products are getting their blood from. And that's the crux of the matter also. But when we get back to our own little country and see how our deferrals are working, that's also, like you said, in England, it's working fantastically, but the blood donors are going down. Is it the same in Canada? We don't have those statistics at all yet.
How would you change the system?
How would I change? I'd get the deferral down to zero and go really based on exposure to risk. That's really behavioral, and that's based on behavior. Instead of sexual orientation, even transgendered people are excluded from blood donations. Mm-hmm. We can't forget though.
We'll be touching on that in just after the hand song. I know that the method that you're referring to is what's being adopted by France and is the model being used in Spain and a couple of other countries, South Africa, for example, where it really is risk based per person as opposed to risk based per group. But the question I think then is, to speak to some of the concerns raised by Jer, is the testing that is done by CBS robust enough to be able to test individually every single time as opposed to blanket blocking an entire group?
I would think yes. Or we have to get there.
I mean, you know, sitting in the working group, that's been one of the questions we get on a regular basis. And it's a question that especially our partners who receive blood, you know, ask a lot. And, you know, there are more robust and more detailed tests. But as Sebastian alluded to earlier, right, those tests require more blood, you know, and then so that cuts down from the donation, right? And then, of course, they're just more expensive. And I think there's a need, and you know, there's a sense of secrecy around, you know, CBS and Héma-Québec when it comes to the testing, right? And you know, I think we need that research agenda to crack open, you know, what testing are we doing? What testing is Britain doing? What testing is Australia doing? What testing are other countries doing? And you know, just to throw a wrench into our conversation, right? I mean, when you look at countries that do ban or don't ban, I mean, Uganda doesn't ban men who have sex with men from donating blood.
Well, if you come out as gay, it's a possible life sentence.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's like Iran saying there are no gay men.
It was really interesting. I mean, when we were doing our research, right, to present a case study, I mean, it was shocking, right? Because you would think that this would be a means of discrimination, and yet that doesn't happen, right? Because the need for blood is so desperate in, you know, certain areas of the world. So, yeah, I think there's a real need to, you know, have this conversation in a very serious and academic way. But at the same time, I think we also, you know, need to take off our hats of privilege and say, wait a second, you know, can we do this in a way that is respectful to research, right? And creates a research-based agenda. Because I think, you know, while we all have gut feelings about this, you know, if we make a research-based decision, you know, we continue to protect the blood supply.
I think we'll be talking a bit more about that and really breaking down by what we mean when we say MSN, and because that's going to come up in the conversation around trans folks donating blood. This is the song Hands, a song for Orlando. It's not sung by any one person, but rather by about 49 of them, which is quite an extensive list. It includes Mary J. Blige, Jason Derulo, Britney Spears, Selena Gomez, Imagine Dragons, Adam Lambert, Mary Lambert, no relation, Jennifer Lopez, the Trans Chorus of Los Angeles, and many, many, many more, including Pink, RuPaul. I didn't know that he sang.
Oh yeah,
Troye
sure.
Sivan. Oh yes, yes, he did. Yes, yes. Now
he's got a number of CDs.
This is true. This is true. My gay card might be on probation now, but anyways, we'll be back talking about trans folks and MSN just after this.
Go. from start. I've been watching news and seeing all this hate. And tell me, is it wrong to want a little change?
Hello and welcome back to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's Queer Media. And you are probably listening to us in Ottawa, in Lethbridge, in St. John, or in...
the other one.
Eastern Passage. I actually told you, because so last week you were doing the show with Brendan, and you said I was out the country.
Yeah.
And then Brendan said I was in Mississauga, and then you said I was actually in, like... Burlington or somewhere. I was in none of those places.
I said Mississauga.
Where did he say? Oshawa?
Oshawa, yeah.
I was actually in Oakville. So now I'm like, I've been, and I go there like twice a month. And you have no idea. Anyway, I digress.
I have a blind spot for Oakville. I have a blind spot for all. I mean, I'm from Burlington, so all suburbs to me is just like this giant white smear.
This is true.
Yeah.
Quite an accurate description in many cases. So we were just before that song. That was a beautiful song. Of course, speaking to the tragic shooting in Orlando. But before we jump to that, we were really going to talk about and jump into the conversation around the new changes for trans folks who are going to try and donate blood. It's important to recognize that the previous policy was case by case. So if you identify as trans or identify yourself to CBS as trans, they would assess on a one-by-one basis whether or not you meet the criteria to be able to donate blood. Mm-hmm. The new policy, as I understand it, is that now if you are pre-operations, so you've not had surgeries, you're considered to be in the same class as men that have sex with men, and we'll explain mm-hmm. that term in a minute. And if you've had the surgeries, then you're not considered in that class, which for me is... that, and we're going to pose that question to CBS and be like, why? What's the difference there?
And why the surgery and not hormone treatment? Because when you're artificially altering your seroavailable hormones, I mean that can change the blood quality a little bit. Actually, surgery doesn't affect it at all. Whereas if you're taking estrogen or testosterone treatments, that can affect your blood quality. Even just in the sense that like. Higher testosterone can be actually a slight immunosuppressant. That's why men tend to be absolute sissy weaklings the moment they get a flu, and women are like, what are you doing? Get out of bed. Do your business. So, I mean, like, testosterone can be an immunosuppressant. So, I mean, there are effects on the blood supply, but it has nothing to do with the surgery and certainly not anything to do with your identity, your public identity. So, I don't know. Like, the whole thing is fishy.
Well, I'm sure we'll get an answer out of them in terms of what that is. Now, in the medical world, we tend to use MSM, which is men that have sex with men, which is designed to include men who may have a wife, may be bisexual, who don't identify culturally as gay.
Yeah.
Now, I know that this is a term, Gary, that you're not entirely thrilled with.
No, because we've... even in French, we've made it even longer than MSM. It's, so there's a basic conception that most people are gay in our MSM world. There, we do have to have a nod to all the different aspects, those who are questioning, those who are bi, and all that. So there's a way to approach MSM in a way to acknowledge that it's mostly gay, and all it's just an ambivalent term to me. Mm-hmm. Though I do respect it, it's just that for me it's too encompassing for the risk and so on and so forth that the people put associate with MSM. Because if you've only had one male sexual encounter, you're labeled as MSM automatically. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you were questioning and you said, "Okay, that's not my lifestyle," you're not an MSM anymore. Mm-hmm. You're whatever you have decided, or your body has, what you were born to be. So that's my little take on it. It's a long take, but it's a little take.
we reached out to Gender Mosaic, which is Canada's oldest trans rights organization, for their take on this policy change. Needless to say, they're not particularly thrilled. Mm-hmm. However, they were not able to join us on today's show, which is very unfortunate. But Susan Gapko, who is the Pride Toronto's rep to Fierté Canada Pride and long-standing trans rights activist, had many, many harsh words to say about it. She was not remotely thrilled with this particular change. You can read up on that in the CBC article. I'm not going to take up too much time here, but just to say that, you know, there seems to be quite a visceral reaction in the trans community that now their identity is being treated as one big blob,
yeah,
and the gender identity is being superimposed with an orientation identity, which is that of sexual attraction to men, or sex, having sex with men, rather.
That discredits their movement.
Yeah,
totally. Because it's just like when we see, I have a few transgendered friends, and even being accepted into new gender. And let's say you're now a woman and you're going out with another woman, the lesbian community doesn't embrace you either. So it's a lot of discrimination on top of discrimination. Mm-hmm. That's not necessary in our... We have the scientific resources to do what we have to do. Let's mm-hmm. just do it.
The cultural issues are important, but I think mm-hmm. that has more to do with outreach and education than it has to do with testing and mm-hmm. science.
I was talking about the blood after, you know. I kind of put them together. Sorry.
My question is, why the change? Like, has there been an increase, or a notable increase in trans folks, to the point that CBS has gone, there's far too many to deal with one by one, we should make a blanket policy? Like, what triggered this change? That's what I'm particularly curious about. You may not know. Perhaps this is a question that we have to reserve for CBS.
I could talk about what the possibilities are. So some of the possibilities include a lot of trans-identified people who are intending on getting surgery but are not middle class or have a good job with good insurance. Some of them have to turn to risky behavior to be able to get the funds to go through their procedures. Now, I don't know if these numbers are still true, but I do know that at least in the 2000s, it was a very significant number. If I told you a number, I'd be making it up. But anyway, it was a significant number were turning to risky behavior to be able to afford it. I don't know if that's still true, because things have changed in the trans community and in how insurance policies are willing to pay for it. Another thing is that if you are taking estrogen or testosterone treatments, it's usually using a needle to make it happen. Now, I'm not saying that you have these big, you know, testosterone injection orgies that happen every week where everyone's just passing around the same needle, but they could be saying, well, they're injecting themselves all the time. Sometimes they're doing it with less than legal materials, because the legal kind of testosterone estrogen you can get is usually more expensive than if you're just getting it from somebody. Like, if you're getting testosterone, for example, it's usually cheaper to get anabolic steroids from somebody who works out. It's not as clean, it's not as safe, it's not going to do the exact same job, but it will, you know, will develop your muscle, get your chest hair, it'll get you all the things that you're looking for as an F2M man. And these are things that they could be thinking are risks, but I don't know if they've done the research to actually show if it actually is risky or if it does actually increase anything.
I assume that the Canadian Blood Services has done some research, and I assume that our speculations are just that. They're just speculations. But
there's
a lot
of assumptions going on here that are not panning out when you
it's
actually
look. It's quite a jump, which is why, and that jump is what's causing people to go, wait, now hang on a minute, what is going on here?
Yeah. But has CBS done any research on heterosexual sexual exposure to risk at all? Have they? That's one question I'd like to ask them, because we do know as a fact that heterosexual risk factors are high there.
Yeah.
So can they at least do that research before lambasting every other segment of our population?
Should we be banning women on the pill because they say, well, I'm on the pill, I don't need to use a condom?
Right.
Like, is this...
High five to that one. Sorry.
Well, and I think, sorry, I mean, but one thing I will say, and Sebastian, I think it's funny that I get to say I agree with you on something. But I do agree with you. I mean, you know, are they doing this research? I mean, there's a lack of transparency from CBS and Health Canada and HEMA Quebec. And this the working group that we sit on is, you know, I mean, it's not the easiest conversation. It's not a table that a lot of people are always comfortable at. You know, and when we ask these questions, right, I mean, it takes, you know, months or years to get answers. And I think, you know, when we look at the blood supply, I mean, there's so many factors, right? I mean, if Canadian Blood Services or HEMA Quebec were to do a research on the risk of heterosexual people donating blood, in the same way that we all have a gut reaction to the ban, I mean, can you imagine what the gut reaction to existing donors would be? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't trust us, you don't want us, well, fuck it, you know, we're not going to donate blood.
Apologies for that.
Oh, sorry. But I mean, you know, it's amazing, right? I mean, they're the way they look at these issues is, you know, from the perspective of stakeholder groups, from the perspectives of, you know, who is donating, who is not donating, and how they're donating, and when they're donating, and why they're donating. I mean, they spend, you know, as much money on this issue as they do on research to understand why people donate, why people continue to donate, why people stop donating. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's really critical. And one of the things we've learned on this working group is when someone stops donating for whatever reason, regardless if, you know, Canadian Blood Services or HEMA Quebec or Health Canada issue an apology or backtrack, people don't come back. Mm. And it's amazing because they've done some research and they, you know, even if they do remove the ban, are we going to start donating? So, I mean, who here in this room is going to become a donor if they remove the ban?
Well, I sure as heck aren't going to, you know, cross my legs and be celibate for the next 12 months. I think Jake would kill me. So it's, not be impressed. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I was looking into it. I mean, the blood ban was dropped to 5 in 2013, which means that 2018 was the earliest that someone could have sat there nicely and waited to donate. Now it's 2017, so whoever that person is, they've just got an extra year.
You're a priest.
Unless you're a priest. Clearly, it's just gay priests that can that can donate. But I'm sure that's for some folks, this is a very important ethical question. Mm. This is, there is a sense of duty involved here. And I think for some folks, the 1 year deferral period is doable. And I think we can't negate
But on
the
other hand, you have to look at it from the perspective of the people receiving the blood. A lot of them will be thinking, screw your ethics, I don't want to get sick.
But
I mean,
there's very little. The problem is that we go down to the issue of there being so little blood. Essentially, this is a very complicated conversation, and sadly, we have run out of time.
But before we run out of time, I have to say that regardless of how you feel on this issue, if you're listening right now, and if you are eligible to donate blood or sign up to be an organ donor, I think you should. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm just going to speak from a personal perspective. I have family that relies on Canadian Blood Services and HEMA Quebec on a regular basis. And if you are able to donate blood, and I understand that everyone in this room and maybe out there listening, you have angry feelings towards these policies. And I'll be honest, I do too. But if you can donate blood, you can save a life or eight. So please, you know, consider the variety of opinions and feelings on this issue and the variety of perspectives. There's other people out there besides.
So you're basically saying hate the game, not the player.
Thank you. So hate the game, not the people needing the blood.
We're playing out with Foxtrot's Driven. Do you want to quickly introduce why?
Shaky Hands?
Yes. Oh, it's Shaky Hands. Sorry, I chose the wrong
track. Well, I've not heard Driven, so I can't comment
on that. No, we're
going to
go with Shaky Hands.
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's totally a thing we're doing.
No, it was just I had...
I had it listed as Shaky Hands. I don't know why I put...
Looking for another song, and Foxtrot played at Toronto Pride. They're from Montreal. And basically, they were good enough that I had three separate friends text me while they were on the stage saying, you have to hear this band.
Anyways, that's all we have
Very
time
short
for.
Story.
Overrun a little bit, and we'll be back next week on the Velvet Studio. Thank you so much.
Seen her cross the line, Vision gave me shivers down my spine. When I told her, she whispered with this voice of hers, a tender yet so clever. She whispered. You're